Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
There is a peaceful solution called the peace revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in. I know we can win it. So let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education, and for the sake of objective comparison, the number two podcast in higher education is the Department of War Studies podcast at King's College London, which, by the way, is focused on the irrational use of force, fraud, and coercion to justify colonization of the world. Thank you for tuning in, and I humbly welcome you to today's episode. If you're a first-time listener and you enjoy this episode, feel free to continue your journey by consuming this podcast in chronological order. That is, if you're interested in exploring a curriculum of comprehensive education. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and free to the public thanks to the generosity of the subscribers of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at PeaceRevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein 1,000 thinkers from all over the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect, sharpening our intellectual self-defense skills and practicing the arts of liberation. This episode is an exercise in thinking out of the box and thinking critically, and it features a lecture on one of the most prolific books in history. Even though today, hundreds of years after its publication, it's thought of only as a children's story. But that's because the story has been systematically dumbed down over the centuries. The fact that it contains observations which are invaluable to those seeking to free their mind, and thus it has to be watered down to be presented to the public, and this may well be its key to longevity and continued influence. For there are some very astute observations, which one does not even fully begin to comprehend until much later on in life. In other words, it's too useful to be effectively destroyed all at once, and thus, it has to be dismantled slowly over time. But luckily, the original text is still quite easy to get your hands on, and I've put some links in the notes for your edification. The lecture which follows is one of the most remarkably meaningful streams of consciousness I've found recently, which illustrates the who, what, where, why, when, and how of the question, what is the identity of this world? How does society work? And what is our role in it? The book which is featured is titled, quote, Travels into Several Remote Nations of the World in Four Parts by Lemuel Gulliver. First a surgeon and then a captain of several ships, end quote. This book, better known today simply as Gulliver's Travels, was first published in 1726 and then amended in 1735. Gulliver's Travels is a satire on human nature and a parody of his contemporary status quo. It is Jonathan Swift's best-known full-length work and a classic of English literature. The book became popular as soon as it was published, and since then it has never been out of print. Swift wrote it under the pseudonym Lemuel Gulliver and published it as a facetious journal, as if written by Gulliver himself, documenting his travels. In truth, it was Swift's way to share what the world looked like from his perspective, and it discloses an intellect much higher than those who sought to govern him, and it is the practical application, step by step, of liberating one's mind to see the objective nature of reality through asking substantial questions and gaining valid answers. However, many people in recent years have not had any meaningful context in order to appropriate the time and effort to read the substantial work contained in Gulliver's Travels. And the multitude of cartoons and parodies created in the 20th century have drained the intellectual potency of Swift's work, which adds to the decline of learning the lessons embedded by Swift in his work. Take, for instance, Gulliver Mickey, 1934, a Walt Disney animated short where Mickey retells the mice orphan children the Lilliput sequences of Gulliver's travels, ending with Mickey saving the town from a giant spider. This, like many other productions, appears to be a purposeful poisoning of the well, preventing the 20th century audience from discovering one of the 18th century's greatest treasure troves of literature. In order to rediscover and data mine the aforementioned lost wisdom gained by trailing Gulliver on his travels, we're going to focus on Gulliver's first and second journeys. There's the land of the little people, which could possibly represent the status quo, which is threatened by your potential and seeks to tie you down with countless threads of law and controlled environment. One might also recognize the land of the little people to be irrational, driven by fear and confusion, and using force, fraud, and coercion to meet its needs as it seeks to use you or Gulliver without your consent, as at its essence it represents the sacrifice of the individual for the good of the state, something better known as collectivism. Then we'll explore the land of the giants, where the king is concerned with the process of how to find leaders who embody integrity, wherein the dialogue between the king and Gulliver illustrates the various fallacies which embody the status quo, not only of the era of Jonathan Swift in the 16th century, but ironically, also of our own status quo. In this way, Swift's words have as much, if not more, momentum and gravity today than they did even in his own time. Gulliver's Travels was an opportunity for Swift to offer his social commentary of contemporary times without directly offending the elite aristocracy. It was in recognizing this aspect of his character and integrity that I identified another mind, separated by time, but tuned in to the same observations as we can readily see today. It's my hope that you'll likewise be able to readily observe and appreciate the quiet brilliance expressed through these dialogues as discussed in this lecture offered by Manly P. Hall. As you listen, keep in mind that Hall is just a messenger of Swift's message, and though I don't agree with everything he says, I think that it's worthy of investing your time and attention based on the value that I've experienced from doing likewise. It's also worth noting Aristotle's observation, quote, "It's the mark of an educated mind to be able to entertain a thought without accepting it," end quote. The point is for you to learn how to observe and process the metaphors, deriving the value therein, without having to become the metaphor in the process. This is episode 29, Metaphors of Liberation, The Wisdom of Gullible's Travels. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
We have a rather curious subject this morning that I think has some timely implications. It has to be sort of reinterpreted, however, because actually the story and its overtones belong to the early years of the 18th century. But by reading a little between the lines and by some fair interpretation, we get some very unusual and interesting thoughts for that period. It all began with Jonathan Swift, an Irish intellectual who had the same gentle feelings toward the English that have since endured. He belonged to a party that found special pleasure in criticizing and condemning the policies of the crown at that time. He succeeded in offending Queen Anne thoroughly, and also, of course, being born in the objective case, he made many enemies, but had a few tremendously devout adherents. Swift's concept of life was influenced by personal feelings and by the conditions which descended upon himself in the course of years. Being a person with a very sharp tongue and an even sharper pen, he had many adversaries. He had a genius for offending people. He also had the skill to say a lot of things that were true that no one wanted to hear. And the combination was a little detrimental to his social standing and also ultimately interfered with his career very definitely. He was working along an idea very similar to that of Daniel Defoe in his Robinson Crusoe, and later by Insel Felsenburgh, a German version. He had the idea of taking a seaman, a man of moderate intelligence, who had had 3 years of medical training, but was unable to afford the rest of the course. So he named this individual Lemuel Gulliver. Gulliver was a partly literate man, but he had the native wit and wisdom that comes from the Battle of Hard Knocks. And so when Gulliver went to sea on various ships, he kind of kept a diary. And this diary more or less supplied the information found by researchers, of course all imaginary, in Gulliver's travels. Now, after the creation of the Republic in Russia, during the reign of Stalin, someone over there wrote a parody on it called Gullible's Travels. And I think it was very much in the feeling of the original subject. Other books have been parodied in the same way. For instance, we have Alice in Blunderland instead of Wonderland. These satires mostly point at social situations. And most of these books are not available easily in this country. They're long out of print. But to get back again to Gulliver's Travels, the book itself consists of four journeys which Gulliver made to different parts of the world. The last two, however, are agreed to be less interesting, less meaningful than the others. The first is interesting, curious, and psychologically significant. The second voyage, however, of Gulliver becomes the very kernel of the message that was attempted. It was in this particular part that Swift expressed his own full conviction about conditions of the time. The selection of two worlds, very imaginary, the world of the little people, the Lilliputs, and the world of the great big people, or giants, goes back to the Greek and Roman periods. Many of the early historians describe a race of midgets or little people, but never were able to quite locate them. We know now that such races of midgets do actually exist in comparative small size when likened to the normal height of the human being. We also know that in Africa there are also some gigantic tribes, giants in the more literal sense of the word, that reach six and a half or 7 feet in height as an ordinary medium. But these were legends at that time. Now, to make the legend almost more legendary, the story of Gulliver's experiences is based largely in what was called at that time Van Diemen Land. Van Diemen Land, later known as Tasmania, has since become officially called Australia. It was the oceans outside of this area where it is supposed that Gulliver got into his difficulties or had his various adventures. Now, there are two points of view in connection with this story. In one, and the first, Gulliver finds himself in a world of tiny people, 6-7 inches high. These tiny people have their own world and their own problems, and he becomes a giant in a world of midgets. He becomes literally the big man. Now, as a big man, he has all kinds of adventures. The little people, first of all, don't trust him. And that might be psychologically rather simple. The more important people become, the less likely they are to be trusted, because everyone feels or thinks that advancement must be gained by some kind of unlawful means. But they are really quite certain that Gulliver is a danger. So he is cast ashore, and when he wakes up, he finds he has been tied down by little threads like cobwebs by hundreds that cover all parts of him until he seems to be in a cocoon. Around him are all these little people in a state of absolute frenzy. They have never seen anything like this before. They do not know what to do about it. They get all the help they can from their leaders, but the leaders know nothing either. So the time goes on, and finally, Gulliver is able to convince these people that he's not going to hurt them. So they gradually release him, but they watch him very carefully, because they feel quite confident that he has ulterior motives. Just what they are, these people are not sure. So now we have the concept, psychologically, of the big person in the world of little people. We have the individual who is outstanding in some way, who rises to the surface, who becomes a dictator or a governor or a ruler, and immediately opens himself to all kinds of complications involving his subjects or those who are his followers. They want him to do things for them. In other words, if he is bountiful, they will overlook the fact that they do not care whether he is honest or not, as long as he is generous to them. This becomes the basis of what might be termed proletarian integrity. It becomes the foundation. If you can help me, if you will get me more money, if you will secure me more favors, I really am not going to question how you do it. So the more they study Gulliver, the more they decide that he can do them favors. And therefore, the best thing to do is get along with him and give him plentiful opportunity to serve them in any capacity that they desire. As the story unfolds, Gulliver performs a number of very useful works for these people. He helps them to accomplish a number of ends which they want, and he cooperates with them in a battle with another little group of gnomes or little people. In one part of the story, he ties a fleet of 50 ships together and carries them off, and thereby destroys the navy that was going to invade the little world of the Lilliputs. This they consider to be very, very good, but when peace is declared, or when they decide that all should be peace and forbidden, and Gulliver decides to visit the former enemy on a social visit, he is then declared guilty of treason by the Lilliputs. They say that this is unfair, that peace should not be declared, that where you have an enemy, you're supposed to keep him. And the longer you keep him, the better off you are. If you forgive him, if you get friendly with him, and you go into business with him, you'll ultimately be in trouble. Not necessarily because he will be dishonest, but because you will never trust him anyway. And therefore, he has no inducement to be sincere himself. So in the end of all this traveling around and doing things to help people and solving their problems for them, Gulliver is brought to court before the magistrates and sentenced to death for a traitor by the people of the little country. However, there are some benefactors present also, so they decide that they would be satisfied not to kill him at once, but slowly. This is rather an ingenious thought, and it has been done on a number of occasions, to slowly destroy someone who you are afraid of. But in the height of all this emergency, an old boat floats into the area, deserted and upside down. And Gulliver, with his friends, manages to put the boat back into some kind of shape, and he sails off to salvation before he is destroyed. And he comes home to his family and has a brief time in which he tells them all about his adventures, and they all think it's perfectly wonderful, but nobody believes him. So that everything is in proper normal order by the time the adventure is over, and Swift has just begun to touch the surface of his satire. What he is really aiming at is far more complicated. And the complication is fulfilled in the second journey of Gulliver. And the second journey is his trip to the land of the giants. Now, the giants are people 8 or 10 times his own height. They're enormous, so that they can pick him up in one hand, and he becomes a doll in the hands of one of the royal princesses, and they build him a little house on a table about the size of a deck of playing cards. He is then in a world of tremendous people, and he is the little midget. Now, over this conglomerate of great giants, there rules a rather thoughtful king who is fully aware of the precariousness of his own situation and also realizes that he has tremendous influence because of the tremendous size of his people. Not their number so much, but their individual size. And they are large like this by a grace of deity. And the king of this country is a devoutly religious man. He is not one of these individuals who is attempting to be a tyrant, basically. But when he finds that he has in his household a human being from another world, a human being from a land out of sight, where people live together on a planet, where all kinds of things are happening all the time, and many different governments are being attempted. The king of this land of giants wants to share the information as to how other nations run their affairs. And this is where the cynic comes through in perfect color. He is here all the way through this dissertation. It starts out by Gulliver being asked to describe these other countries, what they look like, what the people are like, what they're doing, and the motives that inspire their action. And of course, here he has an opportunity to say all kinds of unpleasant things about prominent people in the contemporary scene. Actually, the whole story is contemporary. It all lies in the area of the first half of the 18th century. But we have to adapt it a little bit to the principles, which are much more widespread and can endure to all time. So king asks Gulliver how these countries govern themselves. Well, he says that in England, for instance, the government is in the hands of Parliament. And Parliament consists of two houses, the House of Lords and the House of Commons. The king thinks this over very carefully and says, well, how do you elect these people? How do they get there? How do you appoint them? So Gulliver is not too certain himself, but he does the best he can with the story and tries to impress the king with the fact that it is a parliamentary procedure. And he explains that the lords represent the owners, landowners, and nobility. And the king says, well, what makes them noble? And this was a question that Gulliver had a little trouble with. Well, they come from noble families. Well, what made the families noble? Oh, they were born into nobility. Oh. Well, if they were born into nobility, how does it operate in their lives? Are these nobles because they are a superior class? Are they in all cases superior people? And if they're not, why are they governing the country? Well, it sort of stopped him for a moment. Well, he said, I guess I'll have to admit that they're not all superior people, that undoubtedly some of them are pretty good people and some are not so good. And then the king said, well, the ones that are not so good, why don't they get rid of them? Well, it's not quite that easy to get rid of these characters. Why isn't it easy? Well, after all, there's no one that can get rid of them but themselves, because they're appointed for life. And the king thought, well, he said, I don't know. I don't think I'm going to take that particular experience and do something with it. And what about this other house? Oh, that's the commons. And who are the commons? Well, the commons are the people, the public in general. Yes. And how do they elect an officer? Oh, they pick whom they think is best. Yes. Well, what motivates them to pick a certain person? Gulliver says, well, I suppose it's because they like him. Yes. Well, why do they like him? And says, well, I guess they like him because they think he's going to do things for them. The king said, that's what I thought. What are the inducements? Do these people that are elected in this way, are they tested? Are their characters examined? Do they pass examinations? Do they prove by back conduct that they are honorable? Are they really, if they are going to be the leaders, are they really better than the people they're leading? Well, maybe in some cases, maybe in some cases, no. Well, why can't they pick them so they will be? The discussion is getting pretty serious at this point. And what are their power? Well, they have power to govern themselves in the sense the commons make certain that the average person has a fair deal. And why didn't the lords do that? Well, they have other interests. And by the way, he says, how are these people remunerated? What do you do about paying them? Are these officials amply rewarded? Are they receiving very strong financial support? He says, well, I guess some of them are. He says, are those that are governing in either house more interested in their own advancement financially than the good of the people? I don't know. Could be either way. In other words, as the king, you are governed by people who pick themselves to govern you. Yes, I guess they do. You are being governed by people whose integrities and abilities have not been adequately determined. When you appoint a man to commons, which would be equivalent to our House of Representatives, are you picking a man of absolute integrity? Are you picking a man who couldn't be bought or sold for any price? Are you picking a man who will never associate himself with projects that are contrary to the good of his constituency? Is he going to play politics, or is he going to take care of his people? Well, it's a kind of a question. We just don't know too much about some of these things. All right, the king then went on. He said, now, how about the various problems involving the people now? Are all the people comfortable, well-fed, prosperous, and busy? Well, not all. Why not? If the best people in the country are governing the country, why are not all the people happy? Well, I guess some people don't want to be happy. Well, of course, that's possible, too. But has everyone an opportunity? What are you doing with your children? How do you raise children in your country? Well, they come and we grow them up in one way or another. Are they properly taught? Are they taught from the very beginning to respect their country? Are they taught that anything that they do that is dishonorable disgraces their country? Are they taught to be neat and clean and intelligent? Are they taught to gain useful trades or professions and work at them sincerely? And are they happy with a proper remuneration? Or are they out all the time trying to get something they haven't earned? Well, I guess as Gulliver, there's both kinds. Some probably fulfill your worst suspicions, and perhaps some your best hopes. So it goes on, little by little. He says, what's religion in your country? Well, we have the Church of England, and we are a Christian people. What are Christian people? Well, they're people who follow the teachings of Christ. Do your leaders follow the teachings of Christ? Are they practicing whatever moral virtues that your sacred books imply? And does your clergy devote itself primarily to teaching the teachings of Christ, or are they more interested in accumulating great wealth in their own name? Well, that's the problem. We're not too sure of some of these things. So Gulliver more or less takes the attitude, you have to hope for the best. Well, the king keeps on probing. He probes, and then he takes a pad out and he writes a long list of questions so that he doesn't have to interrupt Gulliver all the way along. But in the second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth sessions that they have, he takes up these specific points in order to try to understand exactly what the rest of the world is doing. And Gulliver says, I had an inspiration at that moment. I'd never thought of it before, but I felt that His Majesty would certainly want to know about it. Namely, that the control of countries is very largely due to the invention of gunpowder. And King says, what's gunpowder? Never heard of it. Well, he says it's some powder that if you put it into a locked metal and light it, it will fire a bullet. Or if you put it in some kind of a bomb, it will explode. And if you put it into cannons, it will blow the walls off of cities. Oh, it's a very important invention. The king looked taut for a moment. He said, well, you know, I hope they did what they should have done with that. And what was that? Kill the man who invented it. Said, we wouldn't have anything of that kind for any consideration. And can you fit that into your religion? Do you think it's all right religiously to do things like this? Well, the elder said, there's not much we can do about it. Several different countries have it, and they use it on each other. I said, that's bad. Something should be done. He said, perhaps you should have a ruler who can handle these things rather than allow the worst to go along all the time. Isn't there somebody among your people who could really straighten this out so that people would know what was right and what was wrong and would go accordingly? Gulliver says, I'm not sure. I doubt it very seriously. And I suppose the king said, if you did have someone like that and he tried to get rid of him pretty quick. Yes, I think so. Well, how about health in your country? Are your country people good and healthy like ours? Do they get three square meals a day? Whether they're lords or commoners, they get the three square meals a day? Well, he says, I don't think all our people are well fed. I can't say that they are. Some of them certainly are having a lot of trouble and a lot of pain and a great deal of unemployment. What kind of rules do you have? What kind of a pattern are you living by? Have you got a good pattern that you're not living? Or have you got a bad pattern that you are living? What has happened to any people who have all the advantages that you've described to me in various fields of activity who can't get along with each other? How does it happen that nations, all governed by elected leaders or born leaders, and with very elaborate means of maintaining whatever ethics they want, why are these nations enemies? Why do they not like each other? And Gulliver, I guess, said something to the effect that it was due to ambition or covetousness. Nations want what other nations have. They want to rule over other countries. They want to have more nations under their sway. Things is too deep for me. I just can't work that out at all. If you have a world of nations, why don't they get along together pleasantly? Well, I guess they don't have the right outlook on the matter. Well, who's going to give them the right outlook? Why don't they get together and agree to do that which is right? Why do they not say these principles are true, we all believe them, therefore we will all live them and we will live happily ever afterwards? Why do we have something else? Well, I guess it's human nature, says Gulliver. Human nature is something that just doesn't change that much. Most people are ambitious. Most people want what other people have. Most people are interested in getting it by fair means or foul. King says, well, I don't think I'd like to live in those countries. I think that there must be something very wrong. Has it ever been suspected that these other countries might be ruled by insane people? That the people might, that the leaders might be crazy? Why should a world be crazy unless its leaders are? Good, sane leaders don't lead crazy worlds. Therefore, if the worlds do not accomplish anything that is valuable, then there's something wrong with the way in which they are led. And there are wrong inducements. What are the ambitions? What are the purposes of the people in these countries? Well, as Gellman said, most of them want to be rich. Most of them want to be powerful. Some of them want to be happy. King said, yes. How many of them want to be good? They're not so sure about that particular quantity. Most people are more interested in doing what they want to do than what they want to do. There's something wrong with the countries. There's something desperately wrong with these people. Because in your world, as you describe it, it looks like it's pretty prosperous. That everybody ought to have what is necessary. You have just as good a planet and just as good a world as we have. We're not having these troubles. So Gulliver listens and answers these various doubts to the best of his ability. But he finally has to agree with the king that the great enemies of mankind in general are the avarices, ambitions, and conflicts of human nature. So the king says, that's how they expect to get rid of all of this, what you might term ignorance, that it's ignorance finally. Well, says, we have some awfully good schools where they can study what they ought to know. And the king says, well, are these schools teaching these people what they ought to know? Or are they simply teaching them to keep on doing what they're doing now? Well, he says, the colleges are rather conservative in our country, at least. They're more or less inclined to stay with traditional ways. They're not interested in great changes. They're not interested in any changes which bring discomfort or poverty to any group. They want all to be sad, to be happy. I said, yes, happy, but they're not. If they're all supposed to be happy, why are most of them miserable? Haven't you the right laws? Haven't you the right rules? Haven't you the means of enforcing these laws? Why do you have crime? Why do people do things that are nasty to each other? Well, they don't know any better. Or they have never found out that there was a better way. And he says, you better go and take a look at your educational system then and find out what's wrong with it. There's something desperately wrong or you wouldn't be in this condition. So it goes on through a number of pages in which Gulliver and the king have long heart-to-heart discussions on what is the matter with the world. And it finally boils down to the fact that humanity is what it is and is going to remain what it is until they accept the leadership of someone that can help them to make it better. And until they learn to be honorable, they will never actually have any security. And they're going to pay for their selfishness with wars, pestilence, and poverty and crime. Now, this was in the early years of the 18th century. And, of course, most of these points were put into the terms of that day. But the substance of them was very definitely honorable and definitely constructive. These giants represented, very largely, an archetypal form of humanity. The truly great ones. The big ones, who are supposed to be responsible for the others. So in our modern world, the big ones can be almost anything. They can be giants of finance, lords of industry. George is simply wealthy leisure caste. But they are the ones, as leaders, upon whom the world depends for the advances that are necessary. Swift himself takes the ground that everything that is wrong must be corrected by the ones who are doing the wrong. That it cannot be done by someone saying, you mustn't do this. That's been attempted for ages and has led to nothing but revolt and rebellion. Each problem in which the group or the individual finds themselves in trouble presents the challenge. And while Swift doesn't go into great details on this subject, I think that the extension of his own thinking leads in this direction, that if there is trouble in any level of society, it must be worked out on that level, that it must be solved by the individuals in trouble recognizing why they are in trouble. Unless they find out for certain that the situation demands some change in their own conduct, we're not going to have any successful solutions. If some dictator demands a change and forces a change by violence, destroying a system which in his opinion is corrupt, those whom he attempts to save will shortly turn on him. Because unless the understanding is stimulated, you will not have any progress. Progress is not legislated, it is experienced. It becomes part of our daily life to learn to do things better. And if we lock ourselves to learning of this kind, we are always in trouble. Learning has at its fountainhead the school system. It is from the educational system of mankind that young people are trained for the kind of career that they are supposed to have. Now, does this system, as the king in the little story tells us, does this system teach basic integrity and place success on the level of integrity rather than advantage or some special deceit? Is education fitting this citizen for a life of integrity which will help him to demand it as a birthright and to cooperate with others of similar mind? If education is limited entirely to skill for profit, we will never have a race of leaders capable of leading a people to peace and security. It simply cannot be done. There will never be an armament strong enough to end war. There will never be laws better enough to bring prosperity to the 4.5 billion people who are on this planet. The only way these better things can come is through a voluntary cooperation of peoples. Each group must finally realize its interdependence and work with all other groups to make all legitimate advantage of the opportunities and resources of the planet. Unless this is done, it's just not going to solve itself. It's going to keep right on getting worse and worse. Now, to get worse means it gets more painful. There are more people out of work. The problem of housing and homes becomes more difficult. Food shortages arise, and exceptional and unreasonable profits burden those who are already heavily burdened. All of these situations represent what to the king of the giants in the story represents completely irrational behavior. The world is made up of madmen. if that is the best they can do. And if they cannot do better than this, then there is no hope for them. If they cannot cure their own ailments, then heaven must come in and change things. It must take away from leadership those who are not fit to lead, and release from leadership those who can live better without it. So the whole problem lies in the recognition that the individual, whether he be an intellectual or a tradesman or a craftsman or a worker in a factory, must be a prophet to the system to which he belongs. He must be right. He must be a unit of integrity in the great structure of things. If we do not have enough units of integrity, no good laws can be enforced. And the answer to why are we not doing this probably goes back far beyond anything that Gulliver talked about or that the author of Gulliver had in mind. Actually, at the basis of our lives, at the beginnings and foundations of all things, we have a humanity in common. This humanity has endowed all of us with similar attitudes, similar aptitudes, similar potentials. Every human being is a unit capable of education and discipline, with a few exceptions of cases of accidental births or disablements. Nearly all human beings can become better. They can grow, they can learn more, they can be more understanding, and they can be more thoughtful and sympathetic in their relations with each other. This is blocked by one circumstance: the desperate desire of each individual to have all that he can for himself. And yet, if we analyze the whole business, if we took every dollar that there is on the planet and all the potential wealth on the planet and divided it evenly among all peoples, very few would be any happier than they are now. Because as one parody years ago pointed this out, that at the end of the division, a few people bought some cheap toys and gadgets, and immediately the others lost all their money buying things they didn't need, and the economic system was right where it was before. The people didn't know. So here we have, back in the days of Sparta and all these times, desperate efforts to try to find a common denominator for the human problem. Gulliver was of the opinion that this human problem could only be solved when it became too uncomfortable for too large a part of the population. When everybody is miserable, then something has to be happening, because now we have something in common, even if it's only a disaster. If we all have the common disaster, we're going to work our way out of it. But as long as most of the people do not feel the disaster or are able to be paid off by some little favor now and then, the disaster will ultimately set in. So we can only assume that the king in the story of Gulliver was sounding at the very foundations of modern civilization. The Dean, as he was called, Dean Swift, was expressing all of his own animosities and antagonisms through the argument between Gulliver and the king. Swift finally ended up by retiring again to Ireland, where he became a dean of one of the churches over there and lived in reasonably comfortable disrespectability for the rest of his life. Up to the very end, he was a voice of dissension crying in the wilderness. He couldn't understand why people didn't like him. Why? Very obvious. Any individual who interferes with what we want to do is not likable to us. We think he should be immediately converted to our point of view or kicked out, one or the other. Also, as time goes on, we discover, as in the story of Gulliver and the little people, that we cannot depend upon a situation in which those who need help do not know what they need, why they need it, and how they should get it. As long as we have poverty, there should be education to teach us to get over it. And it should be very definitely an honorable policy. As long as there is crime, some way virtue has to be established. Now, there are ways sometimes in which religion can step in on these problems. So Gulliver has a little something to do about that also. He felt that the most important single factor, probably, was religious integrity. If the individual kept his faith would keep him. If he did not keep his faith, it did no good at all. But in order to keep his faith, he must trust his faith. That's another point of great importance. Those who become his spiritual leaders must set appropriate examples. The great example for spiritual leadership in the Christian world is the life of Christ. A man who had no wealth, who had no worldly authority or influence, a person with no personal ambitions, who dedicated his life to the service of others and died for his convictions. Now, this becomes the basis of a moral code. Now, if people in religion recognize that what church they belong to is actually of little or no importance, the important thing is, what do they live? Are they out really trying to live a good religious life? Are they controlling their intemperances? Are they overcoming their intolerances? Are they gearing their life to helpfulness to others? Are they living as simply as possible? And at the same time, having a full life through the development of internal resources. The king points out the importance of religion in the possible solution of the problem, and that religion is an essential part of man's education. No one who is sacrilegious or non-religious can be considered educated. An educated person is not one with a trade or a profession alone. It is a person who understands life, accepts life, and rejoices in virtue wherever it exists. So that the religion cannot be confused with theology. Theology is creedal. Religion is non-creedal. Theology gives a certain spiritual reward for attachment to a faith. Real religion gives a reward for the performance of the spiritual deeds of virtue. So it becomes important before a religion can lead a people out of the wilderness and into some better land, that religion itself be above suspicion. It must be a religion the principles of which are acceptable to all races, all nations, and all peoples. We know, for instance, that the Golden Rule exists in nearly 40 religions. Therefore, it is above creedal limitation of any kind. The whole theory of religion may be disseminated by means of various symbols, creeds, and cults. But in the heart of every believer, there must be a proper spirit of generosity, understanding, sympathy, and mutual affection with the members of all other religions. There is no way of bringing this world together unless the faith of people in a larger life brings them together. So we have this problem, which is comparatively ignored in our present time. In fact, we do everything possible to ignore it. That some way, the principles of religion, whether they be theologized or secularized, the principles must be part of education. Until education places honesty above wealth, integrity above success, there can never be any general improvement in mankind. The individual who has lived without religious consolation until he reaches his 60s or 70s is a poor candidate for participation in a better religious world. A few will make it and will make wonderful gifts to humanity. But for the most part, individuals in later life are too tired to crusade. They are content to discuss matters only with those who are of similar mind and heart. But without religious leadership, we are not going to solve the problem. That brings another point into focus. How are we going to select leaders? The king of the country in where the giants live said there has to be a very definite way of controlling leadership. In other words, if the individual cannot get a job without a resume, he should not be a senator without a resume. He should be able to prove fitness. He should not depend upon the buying power in the selection of votes. He should and must be capable of proving that he is at least 1% above the people who elect him. And this 1% is not wealth or shrewdness or glamour. It is knowledge. A real basic insight into problems and a dedication of heart and mind to solve problems rather than to protect personal appointments. Also, the leaders of a country must never gather in the back room and do things or say things that the public that elects them do not know. There may be things that have to be handled with discretion, but they must never be a conspiracy of government against the people. And if there is, the people gradually lose all respect for those who govern them. The main point of government, as Plato points out, and apparently Plato and his philosophy played a considerable part in the story of Gulliver. Plato said, the best must lead, and the best must be best to those whom they lead. In other words, the leader must have the basic respect of those he leads. They must never question his integrity or be brought into the examples of perversity which disfigure public appointments. If the leader is just, honest, unselfish, and fair, he can contribute to the preservation of his people. But if the leader is looking for fame, or trying to fulfill ambitions, or trying to advance the causes of minorities above the good of the people, he's in trouble. Now, off in the land beyond Tasmania, or wherever it was this story is settled, the problems that we know now existed apparently mostly as mental emergencies. The king was looking to the future. He wanted to know how things should be done, and he wanted to prevent rather than cure any difficulties that might arise in his kingdom of giants. He wanted to be one ahead in matters of solution. In other words, regardless of what other people think or how they think, the accepted leader must have a plan that will work, and a plan that is based upon the greater good to the greater number. As soon as the leader starts planning for himself and his clique, there's trouble. So we have all these little problems that can be brought home to us in these rather hectic days where we live now. And all the world is now more or less made up of giants. There are not too many little people floating around. What we would call little people today are giants short of change, but they're all there just the same. But we, in comparison to the ancients, we are all giants. 100 years ago, many of the things we now take as commonplace were unknown. And our standard of living is infinitely higher even now than it has ever been known in the history of the world. But we, being giants, we have to plan a future for giants and not a future for midgets. And if we're not careful and get down to midget size, then all the futures we plan will be meaningless. The more powerful, influential, and intelligent groups must plan a future. Now, a lot of people are planning futures in their own way, but we have to get above, behind, and beyond the Wall Street Journal. We have to do something that is planning a future which is good. And what we want in the future, what do we want most of all in the future? Probably today the thing that we want most of all is world peace. This we are deeply concerned with. Because sometime our children and their children will have to pay for a mistake if we make it now. World peace seems to most people completely impossible. In fact, most of the statisticians of today are not even willing to assume the possibility that we can go on indefinitely without strife. And yet, actually, if you travel among different people, I've traveled among, I think, most of the nations of the world, these people are not warmongers. They are not miserable wretches trying to kill somebody. Their fathers and mothers and children living maybe on a low standard of life, but still they want life, and they are more inclined to be kind, generous, thoughtful in the sharing of what they have than those who have much more. The people of the world do not want war. If the people do not want it, why do we have it? Answer is that we've been unable to control the ambitions of individuals who rise among peoples, the Napoleons, the Hitlers, the Mussolinis. These we have not been able to control, and we therefore are in the midst of a power grab in a world that can't afford it. And this power grab is going to end in universal bankruptcy, both physical and psychological. We should be out trying to help people to outgrow the causes of their own strife. We can never bring peace by trying to make nations strong against each other. We've got to make individuals strong in principle so that they can get together and solve their problems without conflict. It can be done, and it must be done if we expect to solve anything. Now, the problem is getting a little more real every day. And the handwriting on the wall is becoming more legible to us. We are beginning to realize that we cannot afford to continue our present courses of action. The only hope for survival is cooperation and not competition. We've got to work for each other instead of working at each other. We've got to find out how, as individuals, we can establish principles that will endure. Actually, the only way is to start by some form of education. We have mediums of education that never existed before. Motion picture, television, radio. We have all these opportunities and all these means, but what we need is a leadership which helps us to use these things rather than abuse them. We have skills today, computerization, all of these things could all contribute to a better world, but instead of that, they are contributing only to the wealth of individuals and organizations. There must be some way to get what we have as a potential into action. Why do we continue to entertain people only with crime and death? Why do we continue to advertise only competitive products in a world that we can't afford to do this anymore? We must work it out. And the king of the giants was perfectly right when he said if what Gulliver told him about the way we were doing things was correct, that we are very foolish and that we are probably insane. Because no sane person would do it. Sane people do not dig their own graves before their time. Sane people do not go off into fantasies that could never be realities. Sane people should never go around hating people they don't know. Nor should they go around following idols that have nothing in them except sawdust. So, Swift was a sharp thinker, and he naturally was not too popular. And he died as an activist, so to say, an intellectual activist. He is never known to have bombed anybody or done anything of that kind, but he had great nuisance value in the thinking of his generation. And his thoughts didn't cease. The story of Gulliver's travels has been translated into practically every language of the known world. It has been in print continuously for over 250 years. It is a very popular book and is often required reading for specialized courses in our universities. It is considered to be a great satire. It is a great satire because it actually does tell us things that we should be thinking about. Now, when the professor assigns this book, he probably expects a paper in which the student points out how completely wrong the story is, that it has failed entirely to recognize the golden age in which we now live. But the trouble is, we are not living in a golden age. We're living in an age of gold, but not a golden age. We are living in a world and time in which we are compromising everything we ought to support. So, where is it going to start? Well, we had an outbreak of individuality, which was marked by all kinds of eccentric action, and was supported by the drug subculture and other examples of anti-establishmentarianism. In other words, everyone was revolting against the establishment. But the establishment just sits there. And I know some of these groups of rebels who went out and established their own establishments and are in just same trouble they were looking out to try and cure. It doesn't work this way. The problem has to be a general recognition. We now need very definitely a personality or a code or a structure or a combination of international relationships which will establish a one-world concept of integrities. We must all agree on what is right, and what we agree with must be right, or it will never work. But there's no reason why peoples of all nations and languages should not have the same basic moral values, the values by which we say, "Thou shalt not kill," and mean it. We should also have proper devotion and respect. We should honor the father and the mother. We should not steal, nor forbear false witness. But if we kept the Ten Commandments, most of our present institutions would fall apart. They couldn't take it, because they're all breaking these simple rules every day. Somewhere we are going to have to outgrow this, so there'll be serious trouble. We have some time yet. I don't know just how long, but the time is being extended by the gradual appearance of sincere remedial efforts. More and more, more people are beginning to see the facts of life. They're beginning to realize how they have been exploited how they have been misrepresented, and how their various institutions have been corrupted by selfishness and ambition. So now comes the problem. What are we going to do about it? Well, one group wants to parade. Another group thinks they should bomb consulates. Everyone has some kind of a violent solution to the problem. We must be heard, we must be seen, and if people don't like us, we must hurt them until they learn to accept us. No answer. The period that we had our people in the consulate in Iran for so long solved nothing. We were glad, lucky to get them home. But nothing has been solved. Militarization cannot solve. Never can. Because it can only mean the constant building up of greater armament. And someday we may use the ultimate weapon. And that will be too bad. We have got to outgrow these foolish things. And the old king in the story of Gulliver says to his people, and to Gulliver for that matter, that things have got to be changed. The things must be straightened out. Sanity must ultimately dominate. Reality must become accepted. Now this sounds like a terrible penalty. Many people who have a little think they're going to lose what they have. It's not going to make too much difference because they're going to lose it anyway. But by careful thinking, they may be able to reclaim a life and build a proper career with what they need and a reasonable amount of luxuries. But they're going to have to do some hard thinking. If we can get these various motions going a little bit, we are in a position now where nearly everyone is frightened. And the fear extends not only through the capitalistic theories of Western nations, but also through the communistic theories of a half of the population of the earth. Things are going just as badly with one type of dictatorship as with the other. There is no solution to be found by simply pushing along the all accepted route. About a week ago, I got a book on written in Red China and published in Hong Kong or one of the Chinese cities. I'm not quite remember which. But it's a history of Tibet. And it is a very interesting document, an official publication of the Communist People of China in the form, in the introduction, of an abject apology for the crime which they committed against the Tibetan people. They are apologizing to the world, and they're promising it'll never happen again. Well, this is something you didn't expect to hear. I didn't when I read the book, but I ran into it, and what are you going to do about it? It's there. And the same attitude is arising in many other directions. The breaking down of the situation is obvious. A few years ago, Chairman Mao had a little red book. And of that little red book, 900 million copies were sold. Not as much a phenomenon as you might think, because one was sold to each citizen of China. And that just about took up the edition. But that book can't be found now. It's gone, forgotten. It was one of this great cultural leap into the future. Get rid of religion. Get rid of all these things. Dead. The new administration is working the opposite direction. There was an article in the Christian Science Monitor a few days ago of the new Chinese policy. Get rich first. Now, this is something we wouldn't expect to hear from them. Now, when they mean get rich first, they mean that the farmer should have enough to live on, that he should have a little profit. And an example given in the newspaper was that one individual who now has achieved and has his picture in the paper in China as being the one who had accomplished the get rich first attainment has a was in the fireworks manufacturing business with a little sideline on agriculture. And between the two things together, he has managed to accumulate a fantastic income of about $9,000 a year. This is the idea of get rich first. They're not talking about millions, but they're talking about each individual having a little incentive to get what he needs. Now, this is a great change from the old position. The change is also found now in Tibet, where young people are not at all discouraged if they wish to enter the monasteries. Any Tibetan now can be a monk without having any trouble with the government. The temples are open again. The destroyed buildings are being rebuilt. And the whole point now rests on the fact that the Chinese discovered that they could never handle Tibet unless they gave them back their religion. And they've done it. Now, this is the type of thing that is very, we might say, astonishing. It's very unpleasant to some people. They don't like this type of thing. They want us to go on as we have. More atheists, the better. We want them. They want us to go on completely concerned with economic advancement. It's impossible. The whole situation is breaking up. Now, there doesn't have to be a great catastrophe. There's no catastrophe in Tibet when they start rebuilding the monasteries. There is no great disaster because a Chinese foreigner can earn $9,000. The disaster is to leave the situation as it was before that, in which there was no hope, no understanding, no insight, no tolerance, but a determination to put a concept of utter materialism at the head of life. It's being done every day, and certain people find it profitable, because the moment you have ideals, you have integrities, and integrities are not popular at this time. So the first job we have to do here is to reestablish them. And the way to reestablish them is already in action. We are becoming more and more critical of dishonest leaders. We are becoming more and more determined to clean the inside of our cup. We do not want this to go on, and the public has become continually more concerned. So out of all of this, it's very possible that we're going to get what we definitely need, and what I think the little king of the big giants would like to have seen in this world that he didn't visit. Namely, a people with a very quiet sense of internal strength, a strength of integrity, a strength of dedication, a realization that we are all working together as instruments of a divine plan, that there is a purpose for every one of us, that we are not something floating around like scum on the top of the unknown. We are people. We have a destiny. It took millions of years to make us and bring us to the present condition. And there's no sense in throwing it all away. We are going to gradually realize that the important things of life are internal, not external. That if we put the inside in order, the outside will take care of itself. We are going to be required to find more evidence of the brotherhood of man. We are going to have to find ways of bringing people into an arbitrational relationship with life. We are not going to be able to keep on nursing political parties that fight each other at our expense. We're not going to be able to do a lot of these things unless we are willing to face a dismal future. So Swift was more or less right in his thinking, and most of those who have studied him give him a great deal of credit for being well ahead of his time. What he said, you can read in the book. The commentaries and expansions on it are original, so you can't read in the book, but of course you can always get the printed version. Anyway, the main point we are trying to make with this whole thing is that in the early 18th century, we were going through a great change with the rise of humanism. We had at that time many interesting experiences and experiments. In the 17th century, our Robinson Crusoes and the similar type, sailed off into an unknown world and were shipwrecked, as in Bacon's New Atlantis, or Andrei's Christinopolis, and a few found themselves finally rescued by an unknown civilization in some remote place where everybody was doing things right. Moore's Utopia was the same thing. It was an imaginary city, but hundreds of people tried to buy passage there from the London shipping people. But it was a world of imagination, yes. But in that world, when you got there, it was already established. That was the old dispensation. You came into a world that had made new rules, new laws, where poverty was unknown. But they were tight little utopias, in a sense. There wasn't much liberty of expression. They were religion-dominated and theologically overwhelmed to a degree. They were something better. They were fair. People had enough to eat. They got together, worked together, lived together. But it was not exactly what we would be wanting today. It would be a little too tight for us. Such as, for instance, everyone in the entire community eating at a common table. This would not quite please us today. Although we may get there pretty soon if people don't have more kitchens than they are getting now. But after the 18th century, the utopias changed. We had the Robinson Crusoe, who was wrecked on the desert island, but he didn't find any nice community there. He was lord of all he surveyed, but there wasn't much to survey except rocks and a few trees. So he had to build his life there with the aid of his man, Good Friday. He built a world for himself, and so did several of the other utopias, especially Robinson Arden. All these wonderful shipwrecks led the individual to find a way of life for himself. In this way, they were very prophetic, because we are more or less in the same shipwreck condition at the moment ourselves. We are not going to find somewhere on this planet a civilization that has already accomplished everything. We're not going to find that, where peace and happiness always prevails, unless it would be among very aboriginal groups who haven't learned our ways of life. But it is perfectly proper to say we should build it ourselves. So the new Atlantis, in a sense, is built by ourselves. We have to go out and go through a shipwreck, find that we have destroyed everything that we thought was important, and then start again to build on a cooperative foundation. The great hope of the ages has been that religion and philosophy, and now science, would make this transition easy, that we would wake up and go along and do what was right simply because it is right. But up to the present time, we haven't been able to break the backbone of selfishness. The individual still wants what he wants at the expense of everyone else. He still longs for fame and will destroy others to attain distinction. The profits, the honors, the fame, all these things still become the great inducements. And as long as this remains, the answers will not come. But now, more and more, all over the world, interreligious interest is developing. If not too many years ago, anyone who didn't belong to our faith and lived in this country was simply a heathen. Today, the heathens are doing very well for themselves and are becoming more and more accepted. We are sending more missionaries, perhaps, to the Far East, but I doubt if we're sending any more than they are sending to us. They are sending them to us now. They figure that we over here pretty nearly need salvation, and they're not so far off. They've decided that something has to be done to save us. And so over they come. Sometimes with a good message, sometimes not so good, sometimes honest, sometimes doubtful, but always they come. And they are given a respect full attention. We are finding gradually that people can live with other faiths, that they can live with all kinds of religions without suffering very severely from contamination. Gradually, we are coming to know the rest of the world better. Transportation, communication, and of course industrial interrelations are all together making it possible for us to have a more respectful relationship with practically every other nation on earth. All we need now is to warm this up with a little good feeling, a little integrity, and to prove to these people that if they are honest, we will be also, and work out solutions of common advantage to all concerned. To do these solutional things, our leaders must be capable of motivating and implementing solutions. They must know. Government must know what is necessary and must accomplish it. Government does not exist to protect itself, but to serve its people. And this has to come, and it is coming. And little by little and day by day, the prospects are improving. This costly a day goes by now that we don't hear something accomplished that back in the 1700s, the king of the giants thought was necessary. He believed it should be that way, and now 200 and some odd years later, we are fulfilling Swift's idea of a correction. So the iconoclast, who really did some very curious things, like the Battle of the Books, which is another one of his, and the Story of a Tub, that's a third one, he did all kinds of things. But in nearly everything, he put a very deep or definite sarcasm, which, however, touched a tender spot in the public constitution. He was right in a lot of things. And between his thoughtfulness and our need, perhaps something more can be accomplished. In fact, it is being accomplished. The distant places are coming closer. Common needs are receiving greater attention. And we feel, as we have always for a long time throughout my life, I know, we felt that in this great change for the better, the United States must play a very important role. It is important because not only has it the power, but the people of the country basically want it. And because it was founded by idealists and dreamers and was carried along by sacrifice and sorrow for many years. So we really hope that here, gradually, the changes will be made that will make this the leader of a great future humanity based upon brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God. If we can accomplish this, all our troubles will be worth the suffering that we have passed through to achieve this desirable end. Thank you very much.